Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. The golden age of the Broadway musical is generally considered to run from the 1930s to the mid-60s, when Broadway's hold on the American imagination was taken over by rock music. That means my guest today, Charles Strauss, is a member of a very rare breed. Along with Stephen Sondheim and John Kander of Kander and Ebb, the team behind the musical Chicago, Strauss is a golden age Broadway musical composer who's still working. In his career, Strauss has won multiple Tony Awards, an Emmy, and a Grammy. This week, the Dallas Theater Center opens a revised version of his musical, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. And just this month, it was announced that a possibly updated version of his musical, Annie, will be coming back to Broadway. Charles, welcome to Think.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi.
Hi.
Before we get to Superman at the Dallas Theater Center, let's talk a bit about Bye Bye Birdie, because Lyric Stage in Irving is currently reviving it.
And yes, I've heard. I'm delighted.
It features Robert Gensler's original Broadway orchestrations and has gotten some very strong reviews. Birdie was inspired by the uproar over Elvis Presley's induction into the Army, and it's often cited as the first American musical to deal with rock and roll. But you've said, I've heard you say, that it also was very nearly the first musical to incorporate rock music directly into its score.
I like to feel that that's true, yes. It was more like what we today would call rockabilly, but it was an effort to mimic or use the music that Presley was doing. He wasn't singing the kind of hard rock or punk rock that is being done today. It used real rock. We had a rock group which Birdie used, and you know, the girls screamed and all that.
Did the songs get cut from the final score that were, I mean, Honestly Sincere has a rockabilly flavor to it, but were there other songs that were cut?
No, I shouldn't say so quickly. I'm not sure. I think we kept the score pretty much as it was, because it was such an unknown. It had no identity, the show. Nobody really knew Dick Van Dyke. Nobody knew Cheetah. So it was not closely watched by anybody except the Philadelphia audience. When we went down there, my recollection is I think they had sold 19 tickets or something. And then when people saw it for the first time, it was a great success. We were stunned. So it didn't have that careful watch that, you know, Broadway does have with every producer and people who've put money into it and said, you've got to take out that song or not. But we had a very adroit director, Gower Champion, and we changed things around. I remember I wanted to take Put Out on a Happy Face out of the show because it didn't work as we originally wrote it, as a number in the Ed Sullivan Theater. And Gower had staged a very impressive thing for Dick Van Dyke and didn't work. And it was his wife, Marge, said, why don't you do it at the beginning of the show with Van Dyke doing a tap dance with these kids? Which I was kind of embarrassed about. It was, I wasn't fresh out of music school, but, you know, that's been my background. And I thought, here's my first time on Broadway. And more or less the first thing they're going to hear is a tap dance with little kids, you know. But it turned out to be a brilliant idea, and Dick was wonderful in it.
Now, you got rock and roll in Birdie and comic strip in Annie, comic book with Superman, and movies with the basis of Applause and Nick and Nora. You seem to be in love with American popular music and American popular culture.
Yes, I would say that's true, period. I am. I was born and raised in New York. I had what you'd call a good formal musical education at the Eastman School of Music. I studied composition for years, but yes, I grew up as somebody who went to the movies a great deal. I listened to the radio when I was a child, the Lone Ranger. I'm very much in love with it. I'm very much an American.
To talk about Superman, let's begin by taking a listen to some of the overture from the original Broadway production. I love that Peter Gunn-like theme at the beginning.
Yeah, that's I do too.
We live in a time when comic book superheroes are everywhere in the culture. So I think people often look back at the failure on Broadway in 1966 of Superman with a degree of puzzlement. But I think they forget that outside of Little Abner, which treated the comic books as kind of a farce, nothing like Superman had really been tried before on Broadway.
No. It was an idea of David Newman's, and we loved it. We just thought it's a wonderful time for this kind of satire, and it got some extraordinarily good notices, but business wasn't good, and it was at about the same time that Batman became popular on television, and David Newman used to say we were hurt by Cape Lash.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, the summer came and business fell, and the recording is a very good one and somewhat popular, and once in a while there'll be a small production. But no, you know, I've lived through failures before. I think it could have been accounted a failure, but it had its fans, and fortunately, Kevin was one of them. This is the man who,
Moriarty,
who runs the Dallas. And he had this idea for a rewrite with this wonderful author. And that's it. Mm-hmm. So we consider ourselves very fortunate.
Now, when it was first presented, it was very consciously meant to look like a comic book, wasn't it? With Hal Prince's production, when Robert Randolph set.
I can't remember exactly the discussions we had about it, but it was a first, and so there was no disguising the fact that this man wore tights and a cape. He changed in a telephone booth. So I would say yes to that. Even more so, there was one number that Lee and I wrote, which was indeed a comic strip. There were people who were saying things in various boxes,
right?
As in a comic strip. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember being a part of all the decisions about, you know, the colors and all that. But I think that's what Hal wanted. I know at one point when he flew, he would fly into the wings, and then Hal had this wonderful device of a larger puppet going on a wire in back, and then in back of that a smaller wire, and so it looked, you know, it gave the illusion, but it was really a comic strip illusion, obviously. I mean,
perhaps the biggest step that director Kevin Moriarty at the Dallas Theater Center has done in revising Superman is not updating it, but setting it back in 1939, the era of the Depression and the New Deal, when Superman himself is still new. What did you think of that when that was proposed?
Well, I thought it was brilliant. In fact, comic books, we were the first that ever tried to musicalize it, so we weren't so keenly aware of its history and his coming. We were aware that he was born and came from Krypton, but somehow we just didn't until Kevin said so. We never had a scene on Krypton, which we do now. And I think I haven't seen it, but that's what we wrote. And there is a new way of looking at comic strips, which didn't exist. Now they've become a part of the vocabulary and the hipness, you might say. But at the time we wrote it, the only people who remembered Superman were people of my age who, when we were kids, who believed in it. You know, Superman was very important to me, and Lois Lane was, you know, sexy, and there was a reality to it. And the reality, of course, had to do, I think, you know, with us wanting to be strong. We were kids, I guess. I was 10 or 11, and, gee, I wanted to be that strong and lift a car and all that. But today, it went from that to what I'd almost call a campy quality, and then suddenly there's a tremendous tradition through, you know, artists like, was it Lichtenstein,
mm-hmm.
who used it, and it became, it was a different appreciation of it. With me, and I think my contemporaries, it was real. But now it has a kind of tone and toniness, and I think what Kevin has seen has been the advantage of that audiences are now freer to laugh and at the same time appreciate where it is in history. I think when we wrote it, though we were satirical, I think it was still closer to our feeling of it being real.
Mm-hmm. This means, you know, that with Annie, you've now written two Depression era musicals with the New Deal.
I know it's silly, isn't it? But I've written a couple of realistic ones with Lee and also with others. I have a new show called Minsky's, which mm-hmm. is also takes place in the 30s. But I don't know why. I guess people don't call me if they want a really hard rock show, and which I feel I'm. You know, I was a jazz guy. I played piano, and I would like to write a rock show.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you wrote a pop. You wrote a small pop hit before Birdie, didn't you?
Ponytail. Practicing, so to speak. Yeah, I wrote it was a big song called "Born Too Late," and so I was always interested in the pop scene. As mm-hmm. I say, I played piano in bands and, you know, toured around and all that kind of thing.
But rock and roll, that's a challenge.
Rock and roll was a passing element, and Presley's hips and his sexy moves were very much part of. Who was laughing? his sexy moves were very much part of the. Background of it. It was so. Therefore, it was all considered kind of crude, and the music I don't think was listened to as closely as it is today. And then again, it was an outgrowth of more folk music than today's rock. Today, not that I know that much about it, but I do listen.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Broadway composer Charles Strauss, the musical mind behind the show It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. We'll be back with more on Superman after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an interdisciplinary degree catering to professional adults. You can pursue your passions and become an informed leader in your world. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Broadway composer Charles Strauss. We're talking about his musical, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, which is getting a major revival at the Dallas Theater Center this week. Charles, we've read that you've written four new songs for the Dallas Theater Center production. Can you tell us anything about them?
Yes. One is this very small version of what Lee and I thought of as a lullaby that might be sung on Krypton when they send the infant off into space before the planet explodes. Another is a song of longing for Lois called A Woman Alone. And one is a setting that I did of the Boy Scout Oath, which is, though I haven't seen the show yet, the endeavor was to show where his sense of morals came from. And he was raised by a couple in Kansas. And so I thought this would be a good idea. I haven't seen the show. I was sick during all of the... I had to have some surgery. I wasn't really sick, but I had a kidney stone. Can you say that on the radio?
Yes, I think we can. What? Go ahead.
Sorry. And then, so I haven't really seen it. You know, for all I know, they're not working. But everybody that has written me about it has said the show is quite good.
Was there any attempt to make these songs sound like they're from the 30s?
I would say I can't really say that. I'm not that sharp a musicologist. It's a sense I have of what was being played around then, or if it was if he came from a Kansas, which he did, that there was a kind of country feel to it, but I would say I'm not that much of a musicologist, nor do I think people appreciate it, except to a point. You know, today, as you know better than I, they will listen to almost any kind of rock and roll, even if it's in the time of Hamlet. It's transcended time, American jazz and American pop, and everyone's doing rock versions of... You know, you name it, Shakespeare, or it could be, you know, the black experience or the African experience. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of Next to Normal, there's a rock influence in there, and it has to do with psychology and, you know, our century. Mm-hmm. So, no.
Okay. All right.
That was
in
a
short,
long answer
okay.
to your perceptive question.
Martin Gottfried, the Broadway musical historian, has said that Superman is one of your most sophisticated scores, and I think I have a theory about why. Let's listen to some of It's Superman, sung by Patricia Morand as Lois Lane from the original Broadway cast.
Oh, how I wish I weren't in love with Superman. A wasted life is all I've got with Superman. To hope that it could ever be is just a schoolgirl's fantasy. Oh, is there no one else for me but Superman?
Now, that number... It's Superman, and other numbers in the show, including We Need Him and You've Got Possibilities, have a light Latin rhythm to it. In fact, because their themes are often repeated, the whole show actually sort of sways to subtle cha-chas and bossa novas.
I don't know. I think, I listen to radio like or television like everyone, and I haven't heard that song in a long, long time, and I did notice that it has a kind of, at the time, contemporary beat. I don't know exactly. So writing it is so much unconscious. It obviously seemed important to me and to Lee that that she was a young girl, and I forget where the song was sung, but they were in this in Metropolis, you know, which was kind of a New York, and I think it's one of those unconscious choices, but I did notice it. I don't know whether I would write it the same way today, but I think we wanted to give her some spunk. And it's a song of longing, but the words are so on the surface stupid. You know, how I wish I weren't in love with Superman, but sung with great sincerity. She really loved this guy, but you and I knew that he was a comic strip hero. So, I mean, maybe that choice of background was a way of lightening it, or the way cartoonists put black lines around something. But it's all unconscious.
It also makes the score sound, to a degree, mid-60s when you think of things like Burt Bacharach and Herb Alpert also in that period.
Yeah, I would say exactly. I would say exactly, which gives it a distance from Jerome Kern setting the same thing. But I tell you, it was unconscious, except that I admired Bert very much and may have chosen to give it a, quote, contemporary swing to it.
If you'd like to join the conversation with Broadway composer Charles Strauss, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. And I'm going to talk to Alan now, who's been very patient. Alan? Are you there, Alan?
Yes. Superman was one of the first plays that I ever saw when I was 18 years old. I lived in New York. And are you there?
Yes. Go on.
Oh, sorry.
Me too.
It was a good night and a bad night. The good night, of course, was seeing the play. The bad night was that I had my car towed. And it's interesting. I'm talking to this gentleman because in that particular time frame, he had a cultural profound effect on my life. One with Superman, and one of my favorite songs was Born Too Late.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, because I was so young, there were these twins that were about 2 years older than me. The song was sung by the Teddy Bears, by the way, right?
No, the
Ponytails. Ponytails.
Oh, Ponytails. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Anyway, thank you for the memories.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, that's lovely.
One of the reasons that the Superman score is still remembered today is the song You've Got Possibilities. It's often cited as the one song that became something of a standard. And I thought we'd take a listen to it. It's sung by Linda Lavin as a character named Sydney, who's considering ways she might improve her boyfriend. I think it was Clark Kent.
Yes.
Your Peoria facts. Oh no, I'm not Queen Victoria. This suit has to go. Still, you've got possibilities. Let us give it a try. I see possibilities, maybe more than meets the eye.
You've written a number of quite a few standards. Do you know? Do you have any theories about what makes a song a standard? I mean, obviously, if the show's a hit, it helps the song get heard. But even so, that's not necessary.
I have no idea. I tell you the truth. Somebody said, I have a gift. And my natural personality is to think I don't do anything very well because, you know, I've listened to enough Mozart and Stravinsky and Kern, and so I never think I'm ever going to be worth anything. That's a long story, and I don't mean to go into intimate details. So if a song steps out, as say Tomorrow did in Annie, I'm amazed. I think gee, it just seemed to me a nice arc musically. I went from, you know, a sixth to a minor seventh. I mean, you know, I think of it that way, although the sound itself, the style, the sweep of it or something may appeal to me, but it comes off the printed page. It's just a great thrill, as this is in a way. You know, I'm not I'm not immune to any kind of pleasure I've given to people. It means the world to me, but it's also a big surprise to me. So I never know that such a thing. When we wrote Tomorrow, there was a wonderful scene change in Annie that Martin Charnin and the director made at the same time. And after the song, it got a big hand, and I thought it was Martin's scene change. It took me a month or so to say, people really like this song. And then Barbara Streisand recorded it, et cetera, et cetera. No, I don't know. That's my long answer to do I know.
But to go back to something you said earlier. Are you saying that when you compose, you're measuring yourself against Stravinsky?
I would say unconsciously I'm measuring myself against the great composers and teachers I have had who have given me a respect for the tone, the musical note, how it works, that you don't, if an E flat is there, to write a note that is so close to it that it doesn't bring any surprise, and the general sweep. As a painter might think of, you know, although he's painting a bridge, say, but the fact that the clouds dissect it in a certain way, I think he's thinking of that. And my there's a mechanical part about it that I'm pleased beyond words that I was given the gift to appreciate that particular line, but. No, I don't know, to get back to your question, that anybody else is going to like it. I play things for my wife a great deal, and if she likes it, that's always a good sign to me. But at the moment, I'm confused about it. We had a song boy, am I getting old.
Minsky's?
In Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh, Birdie, okay.
Called One Boy,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was going to be a big hit. It never was.
Hmm. A listener has emailed us with a question asking, what do you think of John Williams' score from the 1979 film Superman, and whether there was any influence on your songs, your new songs that you wrote?
No, I would say I love the score. I think Williams is an incredibly gifted composer, but... No, it had no influence, no, per se, you know, but, you know, we all come from the same source, Bach, something, but no, not specifically, but it was a wonderful score, wonderful sweeping, flying music, and I can really appreciate it because I've written for films, too.
My guest is Broadway composer Charles Strauss, and if you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. And now I'd like to talk to Jane from Dallas. Jane, are you there?
Yes. Good afternoon. Mr. Strauss, I wanted to thank you so much for a not a very well-known song, but I think it comes from Bye Bye Birdie, and it's called A Mother Doesn't Matter Anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And I sang in a little ensemble group several years ago and got to sing that song several times. And
that's lovely. Lee will be very
happy.
I love
that song. It just so nails the frustrations and the feeling... taken for granted and neglected of all mothers. You know, I sold my Tiffany lamp so you could go to camp. And, you know, I trudged through snow and sleet so I could buy your licorice. And I personally hate licorice. And every time I sang that, I was in heaven because...
Oh, Lee will be so happy when I tell him about this call.
Oh, my gosh. It is just one of the greatest songs ever, ever written. And
thank you. Thank you so much.
So much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, there's certainly a happy response to your songs.
Yes. Yeah, it's gratifying beyond words. I think I share that with probably the whole world, that, you know, when you get that watch after 25 years of service, or maybe when your father complimented you on something you did in school, it's an amazing surprise. At least it is to me. I never expected it. Maybe there are some children who just know they're good and they know they're cute and they know they're talented. It's always been a big question to me, which I think is what drives me so much. I compose all the time. I'm a very, very happy man. And every day I get up and I'm writing, and I love it.
In fact, your memoir was called Put on a Happy Face.
Right.
That seems to be one of your characteristic qualities, is
well,
an optimism.
Well, I would admit to it.
It sounds like you were sort of ashamed of admitting that.
Well, you know, I was a fat kid. I was never popular. I think that's the way of many people who try to create. It's a way of, I don't know why they would take a piece of paper and get so fulfilled about drawing a face or the sunshine. But I've been trained to do it all my life. It's the way that I get genuine pleasure out of putting notes down.
I'm going to have to take a break right now. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. If you'd like to join our conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Charles Strauss after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an interdisciplinary degree catering to professional adults. You can pursue your passions and become an informed leader in your world. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. My guest today is composer Charles Strauss, the Broadway musical mind behind Bye Bye Birdie at Lyric Stage and It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman at the Dallas Theater Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. And Laura has been very patient, so let's talk to Laura from Colleyville. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I just wanted to tell Mr. Strauss thank you for the joy I received from listening to the music from Bye Bye Birdie. And I wanted to tell him a story. After I got married and had my daughter, I thought that she would just love everything I did. And she didn't like anything I liked, whether it was a book or a TV show or a movie. She would always say, I don't like that. So one day I was shopping and I saw the movie on the shelf, Bye Bye Birdie, and I said, oh, I've got to buy that for my daughter. And I took it home and we watched the movie together, and I was expecting her to say, oh, I don't like that. Instead, she looked at me and she said, thank you, Mom. That was wonderful.
Well, thank you for telling me that. That's it. I have children, and it's a lovely compliment when your child does admire anything of yours, but aside from the fact that it was mine. Thank you.
Well, you are so welcome. You just brought so much joy into my life. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Now, in the, I don't know how involved you were in the revision of.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I said I don't know how involved you were in the revision of Superman, but we've read that the DC Comics was not keen on the revisions going too far outside of what the musical was originally.
That's correct. They they're very jealous about the their stamp on it, their copyright. But I hope they'll be pleased with this production. From everything I hear, they should be. But people guard their copyrights very, very cautiously.
Well, especially now after Superman has become such a worldwide franchise.
Right.
Clearly the theater center is invested in this with the hopes that it might go somewhere beyond just Dallas.
Yes.
But is DC Comics concerned about that, about this kind of outside of their control?
I don't know, tell you the truth. I've heard almost exactly what you've heard, that there are forces up there who think that it's being wrested from them.
Hmm.
But we do have the musical rights, and we certainly haven't wanted to malign them in any way.
What the situation must have been very different when you dealt with DC in the mid-60s. Did they?
I think it was they just thought us a couple of weirdos. I mean, nobody had ever done it before, and we thought it was a weird and appealing idea for that reason.
And with the speaking of revivals, I've also read that there may be the possibility of updating Annie. Do you know? Have you already decided what direction that might take?
Yes, I would say that is mostly untrue. We're not going to update it. It's going to be redirected. We haven't decided who the director is going to be, and it's going to be a new production, and it's going to be on Broadway. But I would say that, very fortunately in my life, a lot of people, it's become a kind of fairy tale that exists away. So we're not going to make substantial changes. There may be new lines that are added and maybe certain vocal arrangements, frankly, which I would like to change, and there'll be some different choreography, but it's still the story of this little girl looking for her parents.
Hmm. Stephen Maines emails us a question. He was wondering about how current musicals compare to 60s musicals, in particular Wicked. He's seen about 10 live performances, but was taken by Wicked, he says. How do current musicals compare to 60s musicals?
Oh, those are tough questions for me to answer. I wouldn't know how to answer. I certainly know that rock and roll in all its many manifestations so far, African and Latin African music has certainly seized the critical bunch in New York. I don't know how to compare them. I mean, I think of Irving Berlin's songs as being masterpieces of their sort, the wedding of the words and the music. There is no, to my knowledge, Irving Berlin around with that sunny view of life. Stephen Sondheim certainly has occupied a great space in people's minds in the musical. I admire his work very much, but there's a kind of cynicism Stephen, in my opinion, a kind of kvetchy. Do you know what kvetching?
Kvetching, yes.
Yeah, there's a kind of kvetchiness about this. And on the other hand, there's a kind of non-literary quality to so many rock musicals today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen Fella and... I can't remember some of the names of the others, and the rock music itself kind of takes you away from an intimate feeling into a feeling of pulsation and belonging that sometimes has very little to do with the play. I don't know. I think about it so often that I can't even remember what your question
was. That's all right. Comparing the 60s musicals to today's musicals and how things have changed.
Yeah, I don't think, yes, you know, to hear a Jerome Kern score, I can't compare it except if I got academic on you and said, you know, that the Jerome Kern line has very definitely a European influence, and the rock deriving from, you know, our country music, African beat, certainly jazz, swing, and all that. It certainly is in people's minds now. I can't compare them. I want to write something when I write. I want to write something that will, I think, move an audience of people that are similar to me. I can't help that. I'd like to get 15-year-old girls to love it, too. but I'm anxious to please.
There was that trend in the 80s and 90s, not so pronounced now, but with musicals like Cats or Les Mis.
Les Mis, yeah.
You didn't need so much the star performers, that it was really kind of the production that was the star, and you could duplicate it all over the world. And you still write songs that really, you know, require a singer, don't you, that really has to be sung, and it's a role to be played by an actor.
Well, yes. When you mention something like Les Mis, I mean, I think the authors and composer there aspired towards an operatic or operatic springboard. It's not beyond my ambitions to try and write something that is more operatic, in the sense that there is more choral music, more counterpoint, more rhythmic varieties, and all that. The economy today is, I ain't going to get it on in the Met. I wouldn't mind it, you know.
Did you try that with Rags?
Well, Rags is a show that I love very much. What I tried to do was, it was a love letter to the very subject you're asking about, American music.
Mm-hmm.
It was klezmer music. It was jazz. It was Russian music. My feeling about that, which is very close to my heart, is that that's where the real melting pot took place. It didn't. Italians still lived among Italians, and Irish among Irish. Everyone said, oh, everyone got together. No, they hated one another. But the music, klezmer music, you know, everyone says very properly that jazz came through blacks entirely, but it didn't. It came through the Russian Jewish klezmer also. We listened, when we were writing Rags, we listened to a lot of recordings from as early as, I can't remember, 1915 or 14. And there are riffs in there that the clarinetist sounds like Benny Goodman. It was all getting together, and that's what I loved about Rags, and still do. I think Rags is one of the best scores that I wrote. Stephen Schwartz wrote the lyrics, and Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, the book. And it was misdirected, ultimately. But, you know, everybody has stories about shows that didn't work commercially. But I'm hoping that gets redone.
Mm-hmm. I read that the odds are something like one out of every 22 productions actually makes it on Broadway. Those aren't great odds.
No, it's... there's a lot of money involved, and a lot of real estate, and a great deal of reputation that leans on derives from Broadway. Reputations are made overnight sometimes, or they're enhanced. Real estate owners, people who own theaters, make great fortunes. Producers do, and of course authors do. The rewards being so great, it's a hard nut to crack, and failure obviously comes with it. And I've been lucky that I've lived through the failures.
I was going to say that your perennially optimistic outlook must help with those kind of long odds against you.
I don't know whether it's optimism, or I swear before your whole audience, I don't know what else to do with myself. I wouldn't be, I'm not happy doing anything except writing music. That's the big advantage I have.
So writing music, no matter what it is, makes you happy, even if it's sad music.
Yeah, well, I don't purposely set out to write bad music.
I said sad music,
music. Absolutely. I get up in the morning, you know, everything else being equal, if I'm not fighting with my wife or some other tragedy hasn't hung over my head that day, yes, I'm really happy writing sad music or, you know, writing music for Koreans on parade, which I used to work at Movie Tone News and a guy writing hack music. I love it. I love it. I guess you love doing what you're doing, or maybe you don't.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation anyway.
Well, thank you.
We actually met about 15 years ago. You were at the Northwood Institute. I had a very pleasant chat with you.
Yeah, in Michigan.
Northwood Institute in Dallas, here in Dallas.
In Dallas?
Yes, here in Dallas.
I was close.
Yes, it was after Nick and Nora had closed on Broadway, and we talked about Nick and Nora a lot. Because I hadn't seen it, and I was very curious about it.
Yeah.
That's another show. I wonder if William Goldman, in his great book on Broadway this season, says that most musicals fail because of book problems. And I wondered if you agree.
Well, it's so complicated. There are a multitude of reasons. In the case of Nick and Nora, there was a personal problem with Arthur Lawrence. And me, among others. And I wasn't able to break through with it. He's an enormously gifted man, and I think he took to not liking me or something. But there were things. In the case of another failure, which I think could have been a success, was with Dance a Little Closer, where I think, again, a cardinal rule was broken, which was the librettist ought not to be the director, too. I don't know why that is such an important rule, but it was. And in both of those shows, that so-called rule was broken. I think a director ought to have a dissonance. And Arthur insisted on directing this show and at the same time wasn't able to see the flaws in his own work. He could certainly see the flaws in my work.
And you've been listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks. I've been filling in for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. I'd like to thank my guest, Broadway composer Charles Strauss. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with Friday's opening of Superman at the Dallas Theater Center.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to KERA 90.1.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.